more time now just to explore this theme of equanimity a little more. And then afterwards, we'll have some time if there's any questions or reflections that you'd like to raise. So I'd like to start by reading to you something that was written by Maria Houston as she nursed her three-year-old daughter who had terminal cancer. She said, "It was right then that it happened. It was such a strange and glorious thing that if I hadn't experienced it myself, I wouldn't have believed it was possible. I forgot that Hannah was sick. I wasn't even aware of having forgotten. It was as if I had been sucked out of the story of cancer treatment, worry, and death. Hannah was playing in the dirt, and I was visiting with a friend. It was a moment of nothing special, of nothing going on. In a flash, whatever had sucked me up spit me out again. Even so, something felt different. Although I knew now that Hannah was sick, some part of the stillness had remained. Later, I sat on the front porch, peeling away the layers of the night sky. The night sky was like my life, each layer a level of experience. No element or moment of it was more or less, better or worse, than any other. Each was an offering to the whole in its suspended, inky stillness. Listening to the night, I felt poised on the edge of greatness, certain that the silence I was feeling was sacred." It sounds an extraordinary experience, an extraordinary possibility in the midst of so much pain and sorrow. And yet there can be moments in our lives amidst the swirling events of joy and sorrow that we too can find ourselves touched by an intimation of a great stillness inwardly that embraces the whole of our life. I think those glimpses of stillness can sometimes truly startle us. They seem to come out of nowhere. They take us by surprise. We can be so surprised to see ourselves move from the intensity and preoccupation and worry and obsession and planning that we're sure are going to be with us forever. And in a moment, suddenly discover an inner poise. It's a glimpse of equanimity. As nature is an unshakable balance and stillness. Equanimity is translated in so many ways, some of them I spoke about this morning, this spacious stillness of mind and heart, sometimes as a radiant calm, a poise. In other traditions, it's sometimes called a shamanic equilibrium. Yet this unshakable poise and balance would be of very little value to us if it relied upon somehow being somewhere remote from our lives. And it is never spoken of that way, but is spoken of something that develops, that emerges within our willingness and capacity to meet all the moments of our lives with equal respect, with compassion, with sensitivity. It's spoken as emerging from our capacity to meet all the changing moments in our lives, surrendering the being for and against anything at all, learning to yield the agitation of avoidance and pursuit of seeking and denial. Now, as I mentioned earlier, this quality of equanimity is said to be so central to the path of compassion. Compassion in this teaching is never spoken of as a one-dimensional emotion, but as a response to life that is made up of many qualities. And amongst these stands in the middle this quality of equanimity. To be able to be still, to open in the midst of suffering, I think we are often asked to put down our ideas of right and wrong, of good and bad, of whose fault it is, of who is to blame, of should and should not. And to learn how to meet the very fabric of sorrow and the very fabric of pain without fear. In the development of compassion, it's probably been evident to us in our own experience that to be able to deeply listen to the story of another person, or to be able to deeply listen to the story of life that is brought to us in each moment, that in some very real way, we need to put down our story about that person and our story about this life. Because it's as if our own story holds all our histories, our fears, our prejudices, our way of fixing things in place in a certain way, that so much gets in the way of our capacity to see anything or anyone anew and to be able to really listen wholeheartedly. Equanimity does not exist in isolation. It is so much pointed to as being the forerunner of wise speech and the wise acts that truly can make a difference in our life. When we look at the acts and the words that make a difference, they're very rarely the ones that are born of agitation and anxiety or fear and craving, but are most often born of stillness and calmness and balance. Hui Neng, when he spoke about equanimity, he said, "To what should we compare equanimity and wisdom? They are like the light of a lamp. Having the lamp, you can have the light. But with no lamp, there must be darkness, because the lamp is the basis of the light, and the light is the use of the lamp. Though these are two names, equanimity and wisdom, the basis is the same." So equanimity is not a place. It's not a state. It's not something we achieve and then we retire. I think in most of our experience, equanimity truly is an ongoing journey. Just as none of our lives ever really stand still, frozen in time, where nothing ever changes anymore, equanimity needs to have the same fluidity as our lives have. Needs to be a way of meeting and responding to our shifting life, the changes in our bodies and minds and all the events that come to us. Now when we hear these words of inner stillness and inner poise and the shamanic equilibrium, they may feel like aspirations that feel almost impossible for us or unreachable, that it's just too hard in this life to find that kind of inner balance and steadiness amidst all the changes, amidst all the extremes that are part of each of our lives. But if we take only a brief moment to reflect, we see how much harder it is on us to be perpetually lost in the extremes of love and hate, of being for and against, of pursuing and avoiding. It's interesting, this word equanimity, isn't it? Because it's not a word I Do you use it very much on a daily basis? It doesn't usually feature that strongly in our vocabulary. We very rarely meet someone and say, oh, I've had really equanimous day. There's other words we use with much greater frequency, aren't there? I love this. I hate this. I look forward to tomorrow. I dread the next sitting. I'm really against this. I really need this. I really want this. Think of how it is when you meet a friend who you haven't seen in a while, and they ask you how you've been. And how often that just kind of opens this door, doesn't it, to this long narrative of all of the events that have happened to us and within us. We tell them I've had an awful time, my life's been like so exciting, I'm so sad, they've been so fearful, I'm in love. You know, we very rarely feel happy to say nothing's happened. My mind has been unmoving. Compassion and poise has been my home. It's almost as if we feel that if we were to say something like that, even if it was true, that if we were to say something like that, somehow we would be perceived as being incredibly dull and uninteresting and, you know, this really boring person, unexciting person. It's interesting, according to the accounts we read, the Buddha got up from the Bodhi tree and he said, I gained absolutely nothing from complete unexcelled awakening. We have to read that a little more carefully. But we see how we tend to frame life in terms of events. We tend to frame our own story in terms of events. I mean, I think that one way of seeing, if we look at our life, I think one way of seeing life is this unceasing, almost unstoppable flow of phenomena, flow of events, one following on the heels of another. The metaphor I think of is like a great river that starts as this little tiny spring that comes to the surface and that grows and grows in power. And that in the course of the river, you have stretches of white water and you have stretches of calm. You have rapids and whirlpools that turn into other stretches of calm. And you can't actually stop the river and say that any one segment of that can totally describe the river. Equally, none of us can stop or even necessarily wants to stop the arising and passing events of our lives. But like the river, we can't choose to have only the stretches of calm, and we're not sure that we want to. Nor can we choose to stay only in the wild white waters. This is how the Buddha talked about equanimity, that in the events of our life we meet what he called the worldly winds or the worldly dharmas. That in our life all of us are going to meet our own measure of praise and blame, approval and disapproval. We're going to meet our own measure of gain and loss, of success and failure, of pleasure and pain. These are called the worldly winds. It's a way of describing the events of all of our lives that most lead to the extremes of happiness and sorrow, despair and hope, craving and aversion. If we think of all of the events within a single life, what the Buddha called the 10,000 joys and sorrows, it seems that so many of these events, so many of these worldly winds, seem almost designed, created, to knock us off balance. We can't even imagine ever having enough armor or protection to somehow defend ourselves, to keep the world of events at a distance. We can never imagine reaching a point in this life where we'd be able to say, I finally got everything under control. I'm not going to be surprised anymore. I'm not going to be startled by change again. Nothing is ever going to ambush me again. There are a few things that are unarguable in this life, and a few things that are really very much part of our universal story that we can count on. That nothing is ever truly going to belong to us. That nothing is going to stay. That nothing is going to remain the same. These are part of our universal story. And yet, it's so easy to have amnesia about that. And it's so easy to find ourselves caught in those dharmas, those winds of life, because praise and blame, you know, approval, disapproval, gain, loss, pleasure and pain. It's almost as if when we're engaging in them, we're engaged in this pursuit of an argument with the way things actually are. To find this place where events are stable. Think about gain and approval, how we bask in it, you know? We're so wonderful, you know? I'm doing so great. A moment later, something else can happen and we feel so ashamed and so embarrassed and so belittled in some way. Think about your great meditation, the one you always longed for, and finally it arrives. And it's just like, I got it. You know, this is how it's always going to be, you know, until the next sitting, when it just seems like a distant memory. Think about our great loves, the state of our health, our youth, our images, how all of them can just change and be lost in a moment. Change into something less welcome. Pleasure can turn into pain. A mother wrote, she talked about receiving a postcard from her son who had died in the tsunami. And the postcard said, I'm having the best time of my life. In a moment, reality shifting. Sometimes these changes, these shifts between pleasure and pain are not always so life-shattering. You see, when we sit here or you sit at home, the sound of the bird you're so delighting in can be drowned by the sound of the garbage truck. You know, the little delightful fantasy we're entertaining suddenly turns into this nightmarish obsession we can't let go of. But pain also turns into delight. We can be so lost in an emotional storm that we're sure is going to be eternal, forever. And suddenly we're touched by something so simple, the silhouette of a tree against the sky. And the obsessions fall away. The pain in the body that we're sure is going to be here forever can quite surprisingly fade or change into something else. Balance, it seems, in this life can feel so precarious, can feel so fragile. And yet we see in the midst of all of these events, we still breathe, our hearts beat, we go from morning till night, we remain present and alive, and we ask ourselves, how can our hearts continue to absorb this continuing stream of events without being shattered? How can we find the equanimity that enables us to meet all of these events with equal respect and without being governed. And certainly we ask very important questions, I think, in this practice and in this teaching, of how deeply we can understand that our efforts to control the uncontrollable are in vain, and actually those efforts in themselves really only make us suffer. Equanimity truly asks us to find the insight of a Buddha. This very profound insight. It's not only outer events that ask us to find this radical poise, it's also a lot of the inner events. I remember being in the US during one of the recent important elections, you know, and of course I'm sitting with a group of like-minded people, and I won't say how we were inclined, but you know, it was so interesting to just be in that environment, to see this arising of hope, you know, and then the sense of anxiety and waiting for Ohio, you know, and this sense of relief and then maybe more anxiety. It was interesting to know in that moment that there would be other groups of people sitting around television sets feeling exactly the same extremes, but in completely opposite moments. And how subjective our world is, and how easy it is to be caught in that whole absorption with events. It's not that they don't matter, they matter deeply. And yet the very, very sense of struggle and suffering that can be born of being so identified with events. Equanimity does not mean we do not feel. It does not mean we do not have an emotional life. It certainly doesn't mean that we never feel sad, or that we never feel happy, or that we never grieve in the face of loss, or that we never have hopes. It is not about the absence of feeling, but about being balanced in the world of feeling. It's a rather humorous story some of you may have heard before about this. If you can sit quietly after difficult news, if in financial downturns you remain perfectly calm, if you can see your neighbors travel to fantastic places without a twinge of jealousy, if you can happily eat whatever is put on your plate, if you can love those around you unconditionally, if you can fall asleep after a day of running around without a drink or a pill, if you can always find contentment just where you are probably a dog. There is something about acknowledging the humanness of equanimity that is not a way to try and make our life flat, or to make us unresponsive, or to imagine we don't have an emotional life. But there is something about feeling or endeavoring to find a sense of poise within those events. If I tell you a personal anecdote, recently I was teaching a retreat with John, and about the third day on the retreat, I got the news that my son had been badly injured in a street mugging. And so I needed to continue teaching the retreat. You know, I mean, I was making sure everything was taken care of. You know, but there was that sense, I'm sure I sat there looking like a Buddha, you know, and inwardly my world was like this, you know, and shaking. But it was, I knew that the endeavor to keep that sense of poise was what was going to make it possible to actually embrace this. And I could just see the edge of, you know, it would be so easy to fall into this whole sense of, you know, panic and fear and agitation and, you know, tear my hair out, you know, or blame or anger. There was something about, I may not feel totally equanimous in that moment, but I know its importance. You know, something that Dalai Lama once said, you know, he said, I cannot pretend always to feel compassion. He said, but I do treasure it as the highest aspiration and quality of a human being, and so I endeavor to do so. So there is something about knowing the knowingness as a way through the difficult life changes, the difficult life events that come to us. So what is the wisdom element in equanimity? What is the insight element? If it's not just a state, if it's not just a feeling, if it really rests upon insight, insight, what is this wisdom element of equanimity? I think there's several parts of this. I mean, I think the first insight element of equanimity is our willingness and capacity to truly, deeply embrace the reality of impermanence. And I think our capacity to do that really follows on the heels of our willingness. Can we deeply, deeply know that every single thing that comes into being, that is born, has written upon it the very single message that it will change and that it will pass? Our moments of fame and disregard, our loves, our hates, our pleasure, our pain, our gains, our losses, none of them are graspable. They are all equally held in the same fabric of change, of impermanence. We know this, on some level we know this, and this understanding of impermanence has much to do with our capacity to find poise. So at some level we do know this, but this place of knowing the intrinsic impermanence of all things is a place where we can have incredible bouts of amnesia. We're so in the midst of pain, or we're so in the midst of elation, and you know that thought comes in, this will be forever, or we fear it will be forever. Without deeply embracing the reality of change, and it's unarguable, without deeply embracing that, we are so prone to get lost in aversion and resistance, and then to become equally lost in forgetfulness as we expend so much heroic effort in trying to make something stay, to preserve something actually that is already passing. Without that sense of impermanence almost being in our bones, we can get so much into the extremes of being for and against, sacrificing our capacity to be equally near all things. So see, I teach in a lot of different centers, and one center I teach at in the States, IMS, it's a bit like, some of you have been to Gaia House, so it was a bit like Gaia House is now, IMS used to be, in the sense of having this incredibly motley collection of chipped plates, cups, bowls, you know, that clearly come out of someone's granny's cupboard, you know, or 50 grannies, different cupboards. And we decided one time, first of all, because they just weren't hygienic, that we were going to replace this collection of plates and bowls with some very simple white plates and bowls. Well, you'd think this would be a non-event, wouldn't you? I mean, it seems very bad. Well, the notes. Where is my favorite plate? You know, I've been coming here for 15 years and my plate is missing, you know, or my bowl is missing. And what are you doing trying to, you know, superimpose this institutionalization upon this center we love? And, you know, my happiness rested almost upon having that chip plate or that cup with that particular writing on it. Now, I have to tell you, this is in a center which, you know, talks a lot about impermanence. We actually really talk a lot about impermanence. But somehow translating that into the very most basic things in our lives seems to be one of the most profoundly difficult things to do. And there's something about what is it that stops the translation, you know, what, because we see as long as we don't live in the light of what is true, we struggle and we suffer and we get knocked off balance. So what is it that stops that translation into our lives, into our minds and hearts in a way that actually changes them? Actually changes the way that we see life. I think we don't always realize or appreciate how much we rely upon the great and the small things in our life staying the same in order for us to be balanced and calm. How much we rely upon things staying the same. How much we rely upon people staying the same in order for us to remain balanced and calm. Until something changes, or until someone changes, then we see how subtly this thread of grasping and this thread of clinging runs through our life. And this surely must be one of the great forerunners of amnesia. It must be one of the great reasons why the reality of impermanence doesn't translate into our bones. Now, in my experience, we're not short of opportunities to contemplate change. Beginnings and endings, births and deaths, if we just open our hearts to the simple truths of a single hour a day, it's almost continually being able to ask ourselves, what is it teaching us? What have we learned today? And I think the one lesson that is stamped upon everything that we experience and feel and touch and think is that this too will pass. And understanding this is really one of the cornerstones of equanimity. I think another of the cornerstones of equanimity is having some curiosity, some investigation into the nature of our intoxication with events, intoxication with intensity. If someone came along and offered you a free pass to a really high roller coaster, a lifelong pass, initially, depending on your temperament, you might think that this was quite a prize. Then imagine if you had to ride that roller coaster, you know, day after day. You know, the initial thrill, the initial exhilaration, the initial excitement would probably change. Now, intoxication, somehow we don't seem to tire so easily of the intoxication of our own emotional world, of riding the roller coaster of events day after day. Now, in this level, I think, of intoxication, this seeking for intensity, there's a lot in this piece because there's so much in the teaching about how almost, if we're not really developing, cultivating our own heart, it seems that our sense of aliveness relies upon events making us feel alive. You know, things happening makes us feel alive, awake somehow. And it is why so much emphasis is given in this path to the whole development of our own hearts and minds, to the whole meditative development, not as a kind of punishment, but because it's in that inner development, meditative deepening, that we begin to touch upon a level of aliveness which is not outwardly generated. which is not generated by stimulation, not generated by events, the aliveness of an inner wakefulness and an inwardly generated happiness, which has so much to do with undoing this intoxication with events that we feel we need just to make us feel as if we are alive. It's like, I think it's like Joseph Campbell once wrote, he says, you know, he said, I think what we are truly seeking for is this sense of being fully alive. Intoxication with events, I think, is a very poor substitute for that. It's such a transient sense of wakefulness, but if it feels like that's what we have, you know, that's what we go for. Or if we don't trust that we can find that inner wakefulness, of course we will pursue events. Now, what is it then that draws us and enchants us? What is that intoxication with events all about? You know, the extremes. What do the extremes of love and hate and gain and loss and pleasure and pain really feed in us? I mean, remember what it was like to be a teenager? None here. Well, I'm sure we all remember what it was like. Do you remember the awful, excruciating painfulness of falling in and out of love and, you know, getting approval and then, you know, the horrors of disapproval, of praise and blame? Personally, I think this is one of the primary reasons to travel this path all the way to liberation. Nobody ever wants to be a teenager again. You know? You don't ever want to have to do that again. But do you remember how much that intensity was so important in terms of feeling alive? Because I think it takes only a little bit of awareness for us to see that our sense of self, that our sense of who we are, is also an event that arises and passes linked and codependent with other events. So there's this codependency of our, the event of selfing and the events of our life. I wonder if you can see that, you know, in a single day, see the events that arise and pass, and see the event of selfing arising and passing in relationship to other events. You know, we meet something, oh, I'm happy, I'm sad, you know, I'm getting somewhere, I'm not getting somewhere, I'm someone, I'm no one, you know, always in relationship to other events, isn't it? There's always a codependency there. No wonder we seek events so fervently, because in the absence of an event, who would you be? In the absence of something being isolated into an event, who would we be? So this eventing of self is arising in relationship to outer events, in relationship to thoughts, to opinions, to reactions. There's always this codependency, and they're flavoring each other. So you could see how your selfing of the moment, or your sense of self of the moment, is flavored by an outer event. Suppose you're sitting here quite quietly and someone in the hall starts snoring. Now, would that be an entirely neutral experience? Perhaps so, but how often we might see leaping into the forefront of our consciousness this sense of irritation. You know, so my eventing of self is being shaped by an outer event. Now, of course, there's a codependency between this. The eventing of self also flavors outer events. You know, so if you're feeling there's a thought arising, it's anxious or unhappy, this flavors how we see the events in the world. You know, everybody's miserable. You know, it's not just me, you know, the whole world is unhappy. So this tie, this codependency is going on moment to moment. Now the question I think we sit with and the question we explore is, who are we outside of events? Who would we be without the definition of an event to describe us? Now here is the source of our intoxication. You know, this desperate sense of need to be someone. The thought of being no one is so unfamiliar and so initially unsettling that we resist it fiercely. Sure, this is going to be very, very bad news. You know, we won't get out of bed in the morning. We'll just be depressed, you know. We'll never create anything again in our lives. You know, we'll sink into some sort of abyss of nothingness. These are the associations we have, of course, quite different in this teaching, which is actually considered to be quite good news, non-self. It's not considered to be bad news. It's actually considered to be really rather good news. But this is the source of our intoxication, and we see there's no shortage in life of events that offer us the possibility of being someone. So the short answer to who we would be without the definition of an event is actually equanimous. It's the short answer. It's a wonderful verse from the Zen tradition. It says, 10,000 flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. If your mind is not clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. Now, the unnecessary things are the positions of being for and against, the likes and the dislikes, the fears, the anticipations. The unnecessary things are actually the changing definitions of selfing. Free of the necessary things, equanimity does begin to flower. Now, the third dimension, I think, of insight that really brings equanimity to fruition, I have already spoken about really quite a lot today. It is really understanding this dimension of feeling, or what in Pali is called Vedana. These feeling tones of perception, in every perception, of pleasant, unpleasant, and that which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Feeling tones that are woven into every sound, sight, taste, touch, thought, body sensation. So important to understand the role that Vedana plays in constructing our world, because unmindful of Vedana, I think we take our first step into intoxication and imbalance. Now, the cultivation of equanimity, we are asked to practice really in the places where there is no equanimity or little equanimity. And that is often in the spectrum of these Vedana tones that arise in the pleasant feelings, sounds, sights, tastes, touch, thoughts. I mean, we have a lot of them in life. There is a lot that is really quite pleasant. And it's really not at all a problem. Equanimity doesn't demand that we resist the pleasant as if it's somehow more virtuous to stay near to the unpleasant. No, the pleasant is the root of joy, appreciation, sensitivity, happiness, but it's also the place where craving can begin to build its house. We can get lost in the event. I mean, if you take a simple example, you know, and there's so many we could name. You go for a walk in the woods, it's pleasant, you know it's pleasant, it's delightful. But we can also take a lot more steps than just walking in the woods, can't we? Oh, this is so nice. I'm going to come here every day, you know. And this time I'm going to bring my book about trees, you know, and I'm going to learn everything there is to know about these trees. And I sure hope nobody else comes to walk in these woods when I'm walking in these woods. These are my woods, you know. And there's so many more steps that we have taken. The pleasant turns actually into a project. Rather than something that's just received, appreciated, delighted in, it turns into a project. Now, there's probably, likely, more unpleasant Vedana in this life that we would like. you know, there are a number of unpleasant sounds, sights, thoughts, body sensations, tastes, but our disliking doesn't protect us from them. And we can take a lot more steps than just knowing something is being unpleasant. Today was a beautiful day. Tomorrow you may get up, find it raining. Ah, how will that be? I'm moving to Florida. You know, I hate this climate, you know. It's so depressing, it's so dark, it's so dull. You know, my next retreat's going to be in summer. Yeah. There's much in life that feels to fall in this ground between being neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's not neutral. But here's where we tend to just space out. We just disconnect. We just get lost in our own world of fantasy, some alternative, disassociated reality. Personally, I find these places which are neither pleasant, particularly pleasant nor unpleasant, I find them one of the most interesting places to practice. And I think they provide some of the greatest clues about equanimity and about peace and about spaciousness. Think about it. There's no event happening, isn't there? I mean, when there's something really pleasant, you know, I can get going. You know, I can get really excited about this, you know, all the ways to keep it and feed on it and nourish it. You know, when there's something unpleasant happening, I've also got a whole lot to do here. I've got a lot to fix, you know, got a lot to rearrange, a lot to get rid of. Who am I in that space which is neither particularly pleasant nor unpleasant? You can see how the eventing of selfing seems to take root very, very strongly in pleasant and unpleasant Vedana. And in this middle ground, nothing appears to be happening. And the feeling then is often, I'm not happening. You know, or we use the more conventional language of, this is just boring. You know, nothing's happening. Life is happening, of course. But nothing is happening that I can actually find my foothold in. There's no place there for me to build a story of self, or much less place. So, often we either disconnect, or we move into craving. You know, I'm going to make something happen. That's why the Buddha often said this in-between zone is often the springboard for craving. You know, nothing's happening, I'm going to make something happen. You know, even if it's just going to the fridge or phone a friend, you know, or go to a movie, I'm going to make something happen so I can happen again. But there is something about, you know, because there's so much in life that falls within this zone of neither being particularly pleasant or unpleasant. You know, look around this room. You know, the carpet. Is anybody really excited about the carpet? You know, but mostly we just don't see it. We just don't see it. Because we have no kind of personal juice there. But there's something, because this is so much a part of our life, that has so much potential for deepening in a sense of stillness. Deepening a sense of stillness. This is not always so easy to explain, but when you look at what, let's look at what an event is. You know, when you sat here today, you know, you sat amid such a stream of phenomena, haven't you? If you're sitting, there's been sounds, you know, there's been body sensations, there's been thoughts, there's been images. Much, you can see it just like that river, that stream of phenomena. And then notice when something is almost like plucked out of the stream, a thought or a body sensation, that moving towards it because it's either pleasant or unpleasant. And how an event is made and how I arise with that event. You know, oh, I really need to do something about this knee, you know, I'm really unhappy about my knee, or, you know, that image arises of, you know, this cousin I've fallen out with, you know, and, oh, I'm so sad, you know, and I really need to do something about it, or something pleasant has arisen, you know, something happens tomorrow. And there's an event making. In the very movement of craving and aversion, this stream of phenomena is chopped up and there is an event making. And I am arising with that event, with that isolating. Now, in its, on its deepest level, mindfulness is non-event making. On its deepest level, mindfulness is non-event making. Because it's the capacity to be with that flow of phenomena without chopping it up, without the selfing arising with the chopping up, and being present within that flow of phenomena without preferences, being for and against, being, you know, great, terrible. It's quality of eventlessness. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's no responsiveness. It doesn't mean that there's no capacity for discernment, but there is no clinging. There is no clinging. When there is no clinging, there is no constructing. There is no event making. And then in some ways we can be so totally equally near all things. So totally equally near all things. That is, I feel, where equanimity is really, really beginning to be tasted. Where you really get a sense of what that equanimity is. And I want to go back to read you again this verse that I read this morning. It might make more sense to you now. It's from one of the suttas in praise of equanimity. For one who clings, motion exists. But for one who does not cling, there is no motion. Where no motion is, there is stillness. Where stillness is, there is no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming nor going. Where no coming or going is, there is neither arising nor passing away. When neither arising nor passing away is, there is neither this world nor a world beyond nor a state between. And this verily is the end of suffering. This is a description of the freedom of equanimity. Okay, so if we take just a moment quietly together, then we'll have a stretch and we've got some time if you have any questions. Let's just take a couple of minutes.